Welcome back to From the Yarra River to the Mediterranean Sea. This is part two of the episode called Where Did It All Begin? In part one, we spoke about a lot, but just to recap, we discussed why we were only taught one half of the Israeli-Palestinian narrative in our Jewish day schools and the impact it's had on this current war. We discussed who is indigenous to the land and the quote-unquote start of the Palestinian people. We talked about the first wave of Jewish immigration to Israel from Russia in the 1880s and how those settlements started. We grappled with the term colonialism and asked the question as to whether or not Zionism should be considered a colonialist movement. And finally, we ended with the establishment of the Jewish state in 1948 and ended the conversation with the fact that Palestinians call this the Nakba. So in this episode, part two, we pick up from that point. We also discuss whether Israel is an apartheid state and what that actually means. We talk about previous offers for peace and grapple with challenging questions as to who is wrong, who is in the right, who is to blame for the way Israel-Palestine currently exists. Spoiler alert, it's both. And much, much more. So I hope you enjoy this second part of Where Did It All Begin? And I'll see you on the other side.
Why do you think you never heard about the Nakba before 6 weeks ago?
Oh my God. I don't know. I feel so sick even saying it. I don't know. I was never taught it. I don't know. I'm embarrassed. I don't know. Why do you think?
I think because the Nakba is probably one of the most difficult aspects of Zionist history to teach. And I think there's a lot of Jewish educators fear that if we dwell on the Nakba more than, you know, for half a lesson, that it will sort of undermine the whole foundation of the state. For those that aren't familiar with the Nakba, I'll just say a couple of sentences. So the Nakba is an Arabic word that means catastrophe. And the reason Palestinians call the 1948 war the Nakba was because during that war, there was about 500 Palestinian villages that were depopulated. So all of the people that lived in these villages by the end of the war don't live in these villages. Many of them are expelled to places like what are today the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. It's about 20,000 people are killed also during the Nakba. And there's about 700,000 to 800,000 people made refugees. And so the Nakba for them is the end of their dream. It's the end of their homeland. It's the end of the lives that they lived in all of these villages. And then after the Nakba, all of these villages get Jewish names. So the names are changed. In fact, you'll go to many of these places where these villages existed, and there's no signs that there was once a Palestinian village there. And Nakba is mourned. There's a Nakba Day on May 15th. Where the Palestinians, you know, grieve the loss of all of the things that they lost in 1948. Within the Israeli narrative, the Nakba, or what Israelis call it, which is Milchemet Atzmaut, the War of Independence, is seen as a war for survival. It's seen as a war that was essential. It's seen as a war that if it hadn't happened, there wouldn't be a Jewish state today. And it's also seen as a war of Ein Brera. There's no option. Because the Arab armies, you know, were obviously threatening Jewish lives and the Moshavim and the Kibbutzim and, you know, what had been built here between 1948. Israelis viewed the war as a war of self-defense and a sense of if we don't defend against all these people who are going to kill us, there's not going to be a Jewish state here. But I think the real Nakba is actually not 1948. It's really 1950. And the reason it's 1950 is because one of the first laws passed in Israel is called the Infiltration Law. And it's a law that says that anyone who left their home in 1948 is not able to return, that if they return, they're considered to be an infiltrator. And so what that means is that the land that the Palestinians left becomes land that belongs to the state, and then eventually that's given to Jewish immigrants from all over the world. And if in 1950 Israel had let the Palestinians return, then the Nakba would have been terrible, but they would have still been, all those Arabs would have been able to come back home. But because Israel didn't let them return, that's really what created the Nakba for Palestinians. Now, Israel's argument for not letting the Palestinians return in 1948 was, well, you know, we were, as I mentioned, 8% of the population in 1882. By the end of the war in 1948, we're 80% of the population. And if we want to stay as a Jewish majority, we can't let in 700,000 people come back to their homes. So in order to preserve a Jewish majority, then those Palestinians are not able to return to their homes. And then that enables Israel to exist as a state with a Jewish majority. But that is the loss of the Palestinian people that they grieve into this very day.
Mm. I know there's a question that I want to ask you, but just as an aside, over the last few weeks I've seen on Instagram so many harrowing videos of people being removed from the north of Gaza to the south. And there's just like, I'm sure you've seen it as well, just thousands and thousands of people walking along the road. And people are saying, you know, this is the second Nakba, because this is what happened. We were, you know, taken from our homes. We were forced to leave. And it feels like to them, this is exactly what's happening again. And so it's harrowing even to watch it now. So I obviously don't know what happened or what it looked like back then in 1948, but if it looks anything like what's happening now, it's pretty horrific.
Yeah. I've seen some Instagram accounts calling it the Nakba in color, you know, because the 1948 Nakba, all the photos from it are in black and white. And I'll also say, I know a lot of Israelis that are calling this Israel's second war of independence, because,
wow,
you know, there's a sense here of 2023's 1948 repeating. You know, for Israelis after the Hamas attack on October 7th, there's a sense of, if we don't remove Hamas from power, then we can't live here anymore. Then Zionism, then Jewish life in the land of Israel is not viable. And for a lot of Palestinians, they look at, you know, over 1.7 million people have been displaced from north of Gaza to the south of Gaza. That's double the number of the Nakba. And so they're saying, and also you've got various Israeli ministers like Avi Dichter, you know, calling for a second Nakba as well. So they look at this and they experience this as a Nakba. And then I'll also add to this the other event we spoke about, which is the Holocaust. You know, the nature of the attacks on October 7th for many Jews, and I think rightly so, felt like another Holocaust. You know, the way people were burned and beheaded and raped, and, you know, all of these horrific attacks. And so, yeah, 2023 has brought back all of our deepest, darkest fears of history into reality again, and maybe that's why we're having this conversation now. And I can very much understand why those historical analogies are being made, because it's what we see happening around us.
Mm. Yes, I have a lot to say about this and Holocaust trauma, but I think we'll save that for the next episode. But, okay, I want to go back to what we were just talking about. So this, the right of return and the law against it. Is this what people talk about when they say Israel is an apartheid state?
So Israel does have something called a law of return, which means that any Jew, including you, Hannah, if you tomorrow get on a plane, that you can automatically become a citizen here. And so can your friend who's Jewish in Argentina or from Ethiopia or from Paraguay or any other place in the world where a Jew might want to come here. They land and within minutes they're a citizen of Israel. Palestinians can't do that. So Palestinians who were exiled from their homeland in 1948, they can't return here, and some of them can't even visit. And so a lot of people say that's unfair. Now, Israelis will say, well, it's a Jewish state. Of course, we're going to have immigration laws that favour Jews, like there are many other laws that favour Jews here. And that's why we created a Jewish state, in the same way that, you know, Greece favours Greek Orthodox people, and many states in Europe favour, you know, Catholics or Protestants, or, you know, depending on their history. And they say, yes, Israel is an ethno-national state that has got to favour one specific group. And that's why... that's why Israel exists the way it is. Now, that's not connected to your question, which is the apartheid question. So the apartheid question really comes from three human rights organisations, B'Tselem, and Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch. And in the last 3 years, all three of those organisations have published reports. I've read all three of them. They're about like 200 pages each. They're very, very dense long reports which say that Israel is committing the crime of apartheid. Before I answer whether it is or isn't, do you know what apartheid means?
Apartheid was in South Africa. There were different rules, basically, for whites and non-whites.
Yeah. 10 points to Hannah. That was great.
Oh, God, thank God. You got that right.
So there's no one in the world that thinks apartheid is a good thing, okay? No one. I mean, even South Africans got rid of it, you know. There's maybe a few white South African, you know, people, Afrikaners, that might still have nostalgia for apartheid. But it's basically, it's a bad word. It's like racism. It's like discrimination. No one wants to be in favor of apartheid. So when you call Israel as an apartheid state, you're labeling, you're connecting Israel to a word that I guess no one wants to be connected to that word. Because apartheid in South Africa was so horrible, there were also these things called the Bantustans, where basically all the blacks lived in various townships like, you know, Soweto. And on the other hand, you had, you know, the whites living in Johannesburg in big houses. And there was this real sense of all of the opportunity was offered to white people and none of the opportunity was offered to black people, both out of a sense of the whites felt religiously that, you know, God wanted them to be, you know, ruling South Africa, and also out of a sense of, you know, they claimed that the black people were terrorists and that's why they had to have all these pass laws and ID laws and keep them in these separate Bantustans. And so people today look at not so much the situation in Israel, but the situation in the West Bank, where the West Bank is divided into areas A, B, and C. And there's already 99 different permits that Palestinians need to travel, to work, to get married, to buy property, to do all of these sorts of things. And they say that the Israeli control over the West Bank is a system that kind of looks a bit like the Bantustan system. And so therefore they apply the word apartheid to Israel. Israel argues in response that, firstly, within the 1967 borders, Israel isn't an apartheid state. That, you know, Arabs do have the right to vote and work and have many of the rights that Jews do have, maybe not all of them, but almost all of them. And within the 1967, beyond the 1967 borders, Israel will argue, yes, there's obviously discrimination where settlers have more rights than do Arabs, but Israel argues that's only for security purposes. Other people would say, well, it's not really just for security purposes. It's also done for religious reasons. So a lot of Jews who live in the West Bank live there because they believe that Hashem promised the land to us and that Jews therefore have a biblical obligation to settle every inch of Eretz Israel. And, you know, famously, Naftali Bennett would always say, a former prime minister of Israel, a Jew can't be a colonizer in the promised land, like in Eretz Israel. Like we can't be doing this in our land because it's ours. God promised it to us. How could you say that we don't belong here? But the fact that, you know, let's say a Jew who lives in Efrat, which is a Jewish settlement, and a Palestinian that lives in Bethlehem, they only live a few kilometers apart from each other, but they have different court systems. If both of them commit a crime, they'll face different penalties. Their whole rights, you know, the Jew who lives in Efrat can vote in an Israeli election, even though he doesn't live in Israel. The Palestinian that lives in Bethlehem can't vote for the Knesset, even though he's subject to the laws that are passed by the Knesset. A Jew who lives in Efrat can marry a Jew who lives in Jerusalem, and that's totally normal. A Palestinian that lives in Bethlehem can't marry a Palestinian that lives in Haifa. He can't get citizenship to move into the state of Israel because of the citizenship law. So there's many, many laws that discriminate against Palestinians over Jews who live in the West Bank, and that's where this apartheid label comes in, and that's how it sort of got ascribed to Israel from these various human rights reports, because they claim that in the West Bank there is a system that privileges Israelis over Palestinians. Again, it's not a racial system like in South Africa, but it is based on nationality.
Mm. I have so many questions again. This is going to be a long podcast. Okay, two things. Firstly, just with respect to in the West Bank, for the listeners, I'm going to, you know, ruin the idea of podcasting that this is like totally off the cuff, but I'm looking here at this table that Itai sent me, and it has a list of all different things that relate to settlers and things that relate to Palestinians. So a lot of those that you were just talking about, but I want to specifically just read out some of them because I didn't know this. So after a crime is committed, this is all in the West Bank, a settler will go to trial before Israeli civil court, and Palestinians, if they commit a crime, they go to military court. What's military court?
A military court is a court that has three judges. And those three judges are like, one is a judge and two of them are officers in the Israeli Defense Forces. And it's a court that runs in Hebrew. It's a court that has about a 99% conviction rate. It's a court that very rarely is seen as, I guess, being objective in terms of Palestinians for achieving justice, as opposed to an Israeli civil court where you're much more likely to have, you know, a fair trial in, as opposed to a military court.
Mm. So on that, access to legal counsel, settlers get it immediately and Palestinians get it within 90 days.
Yeah, no. So a lot of Palestinians, they can also, in addition to, there's another one here that if an Israeli is arrested, usually within a couple of days they'll be told what they're arrested for. They'll say you're charged with this crime, and then you can make a case to defend yourself. A lot of Palestinians are arrested and they're not told what the crime is, and so it's almost impossible to defend yourself, for you don't know what the crime is that you have committed, and that's something called administrative detention. And there's over 2,000 Palestinians now in jail in Israel under administrative detention, where the reason they're not told their crime is because maybe a Palestinian informant gave Israel some information, and so telling them what the crime is would sort of compromise that Palestinian informant, or it involves some other security-related matter that they don't want to give the defense judge all the information because it could harm the security of Israel. But a lot of Palestinians say, well, you can't call this a democracy. You can't have two different legal systems in the West Bank and say that's a democracy. You can't have one group of people voting and another group of people not voting and call that a democracy. You can't allow one people to travel wherever it wants to and another people not to travel and call that a democracy. So that's where a lot of these labels like, you know, apartheid, racism, discrimination come from, because a lot of Palestinians say that's not what happens in democratic states like, you know, Australia or New Zealand or Canada.
Mm.
Israel then says, look, you do have somewhere where you can vote, which is the Palestinian Authority. They just don't give you elections. You know, Abu Mazen has been in power for 17 years without an election, and Hamas also hasn't had elections for 17 years as well. So they would say, like, well, you know, if you want democracy, then speak to the Palestinian leaders that you have and ask them for democracy. But their argument is, well, our Palestinian leaders don't really run most of our lives. Most of our lives, most of what determines our well-being is decided from the Knesset in Jerusalem. We don't have a say in probably the most significant governing body that exists between the river and the sea.
Okay, I've got two more questions on this, sorry, and then we can keep moving on. The first is that, is this only really about the West Bank? Like, what are Palestinians or non-Jews treated in, you know, Israel proper? Would people say it's an apartheid state in proper, you know, Israel?
I think it would be very hard to make the argument that there's apartheid being practiced in Israel proper, for reasons that I've stated already, but also because largely Arabs within Israel have almost the same rights as Jews. Probably the main two places where they don't is with the Jewish Nation State Law passed in 2018, and also with the law of return, which obviously only applies to Jews. But then there's also, I'd say, a lot of what I would call not legal but sort of practical discrimination that happens within Israel. So in terms of employment, so people will, you know, you'll see a job ad and it will say, as one of the criteria for the job, you have to have served in the IDF. So that already excludes just about every Arab in the country. Or when Israel is allocating budgets to where they're going to build a hospital, then Jewish towns will get it first. You know, I'll just give you a simple example. You know, Arabs are 20% of the population in Israel. There's not one train station in an Arab village. You know, how could that be? How could you make a whole train network and not think, you know, Baqa al-Gharbiya deserves a train station? You know, like, or most of the major hospitals in Israel are in Jewish majority cities or in the Jewish parts of majority cities. So, you know, even Wi-Fi in Baqa al-Gharbiya is nowhere near as good as Wi-Fi in Jewish settlements. So they would say that there's chronic, I guess, underfunding, underdevelopment of Arab areas in favor of Jewish areas. And again, that's not the same as apartheid in South Africa, but that is sort of a discrimination in favor of Jews, which makes a lot of Arab citizens of Israel very unhappy about the current system of government here.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And my second question is back to the West Bank. And I can understand why people say what's happening in the West Bank is apartheid. Something that I saw when I went there on one of the Breaking the Silences tours is just the heavy IDF presence that is there. And I'm not sure whether that's, you'll have to remind me about whether that's because it was in one of the areas where it's shared between Palestinians and Jews.
Yeah, you're probably talking about Hebron or Al-Khalil, yeah.
Yeah, or somewhere near there. But there's just like a really, really heavy, heavy IDF presence there. And they're basically there just to, I don't know if it's intimidate or scare Palestinians, make sure they're not, you know, acting up in quotation marks. They're just like, you know, around outside their houses, sometimes, you know, going into houses without search warrants or things like that. Is that true? Am I making that up? Are the soldiers on Breaking the Silence tour making that up? What do you say about that?
So Hebron is a very ancient city. And it's probably one of the, for me at least, the ugliest places of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, because I think it brings out our worst. And it should be a really holy place because it's where Abraham is buried, or Ibrahim in Islam, and he's the founder of monotheism. And literally you go to Abraham's tomb and on one side of the fence Jews are praying and on the other side of the fence Muslims are praying. Obviously, after the Baruch Goldstein massacre there in 1994, that's become a very, very tense place. And there's constant clashes between the two populations there. And I often think, you know, if Abraham was alive today, if he's looking down from heaven and he's seeing, you know, the children of Isaac and the children of Ishmael, what they're doing over Hebron, I think he could only cry. It's just heartbreaking how it's become a city where there's so much violence and there's so many division and so much walls. And I think that's why if you want to learn about the occupation, you go to Hebron. And when Breaking the Silence do tours there, I think what they're trying to show you is the main street, which was Shuhada Street, which used to be like a market, like Machne Yehuda, you know, lively and filled with people for, you know, almost over 20 years now, is basically a ghost town. Like you walk through it and only Jews can go through and many shops are closed. And Hebron has a very small Jewish settlement of about 400 people, and there's a larger settlement next to it called Kiryat Arba, where Itamar Ben-Gvir lives. And there's an immense amount of security there to defend the lives of a very, very small Jewish group who make the lives of Palestinians around them miserable. And so a lot of people say if the Jews didn't live in Hebron, then the Palestinians in Al-Khalil would have a lot more freedom and ability to access their shops and their mosques and, you know, all of those sorts of places. And then the Jews who live there say, well, we have to live in Hebron because this is an ancient Jewish tomb and we have to be close to it. And if we need lots of security, then so be it. But the kind of Jews that live there often tend to be the most, you know, extremist and radical of the Jews. And also the Palestinians that live in Al-Khalil tend to be also the most extreme of the Palestinians. So, and that causes, obviously, you know, to make Hebron a very, very unpleasant place. And, you know, I wish it wasn't that way.
Mm. Is it only in Hebron, or is it like my understanding was, you know, on that tour, I don't think I actually went to Hebron. I went to another settlement, and it was like it used to be a Palestinian community, And then it got taken over by a Jewish settlement, and a whole settlement was built basically where that Palestinian community is. And now they basically just live in tents, kind of. There's no actual community. The settlement was built on their water supply, so they didn't have access to water. They have to walk like a day to get water and then bring it back. And around that little community is that, this is what they said, that there's often just IDF soldiers coming in and checking on them, not in like a safety way, kind of like in an intimidation way, because they live so close to the settlement and they just, you know, don't want any, you know, they don't want any uprising or resistance or whatever.
Yes, I don't know the exact place you're talking about, but it sounds like you're talking about something in Area C. And in Area C, that's a very common story where there are Palestinian villages have been depopulated for various reasons. Masaf Eliyata is probably one that's undergoing that at the moment, that's, you know, been in the news a lot. And the IDF is there obviously primarily to care for Jewish interests and Jewish lives, and the Palestinians don't have an army that can look after them and their well-being and protect their land and their olive groves and their sheep and whatever homes that they have in those places. And so, yeah, there's a great sense of oppression that they feel in the West Bank, and that obviously generates a lot of anger towards not just towards the settlers, but towards all Israelis and sometimes towards all Jews.
Okay, yeah, that is definitely some stuff I did know and some I didn't. And something that I think a lot of people are wondering, definitely I am, is could you have seen Israel turning out a different way? Like, why did it actually turn out this way, and could it have been different, even from 1948?
There's lots of ways it could have been different, but, you know, unfortunately I don't have the power to change the past. I can only change the future in my limited ability. But I often think when I'm asked that question about the first ever exchange of letters between a Palestinian and a Zionist, it happened in 1899, over 120 years ago, where Yusuf Deir Pasha al-Khalidi, who was later on the mayor of Jerusalem, he wrote a letter to Theodor Herzl, and he said to him the following, as he sort of got wind of the fact that the Jews were keen on establishing a state here, and he said, "Who can deny the rights of the Jews to Palestine? My God, historically, it is also your country. However, since Palestine is already inhabited, Zionists should find another place for the implementation of their political goals. In the name of God, let Palestine be left alone." It's quite an amazing letter, because what Khalidi is saying to him is, on the one hand, I know why you guys want to be here. I know that you have a historic connection to this place, and I can't deny that you belong here. But on the other hand, I want you to know that there's already another people here, already in 1899, and please just set up this state of yours somewhere else. So Herzl wrote back to him a week later. Before I tell you what Herzl wrote, what do you think Herzl wrote back? And Herzl takes the letter quite seriously. Oh,
you're such a teacher, Itai, asking me the questions. This is not a classroom. This is a podcast, and I am interviewing you.
Yeah.
I don't know what Herzl said. You tell me.
All right, this is what Herzl says. He says, okay, when immigration is permitted that allows Jews to bring their intelligence, financial acumen and entrepreneurial skills to the land, I have no doubt that the welfare of the nation as a whole will benefit, and this will cause gladness. The holy places are not exclusive to one faith, one race, or one people. The holy places are and will remain holy for the entire world. If the Zionists are not welcome, we will search, and believe me, we will find somewhere else if needed.
Hmm. So, wait, he says, when immigration is permitted that allows Jews to bring their intelligence, financial acumen and entrepreneurial skills to the land, I have no doubt that the welfare of the nation as a whole benefit and cause gladness. Sorry, but that does sound a bit colonialist to me, doesn't it? Or a bit like we're a Western idea, bringing it, like the Westerns are better and we're going to bring our intelligence and financial acumen to another country.
Look, it sounds like something you would read in Startup Nation. You know, like, you want Jews here. Mm. Jews will make life good for you. We'll bring in money. We're good with business. We'll develop the country. And don't worry about us. We don't have any bad intentions. And just trust me, it's going to be okay. That's kind of what he's saying. And then the second part, which I found fascinating when I first read the letter, was, but also we're not here to start a fight, and if it doesn't work out, we'll go somewhere else. And maybe Herzl's already thinking of Uganda. And the reason I find this letter fascinating is because it has two things that all Palestinians and Israelis say today, and two things that Palestinians and Israelis never say today. The two things it has that a lot of Palestinians and Israelis say today is, one, Khalidi telling Herzl, Palestine has people in it. We are here. We are a nation. You should see us as a nation and remember that you're trying to establish a national home in someone else's country. And the thing that Jews often say to Palestinians is, you're better off with us than with the Jordanians or with the Egyptians or with the Saudis or with the Syrians or with the Lebanese. And like, it's going to be good for you here and you should be happy to be here. So that's arguments that you've heard for 120 years and you're still here today. The bit that you don't hear that's in these two letters is fascinating. The bit that you don't hear is the bit where Khalidi says, I acknowledge that you belong here. I know that the Jews have a connection to this place. Today, you don't hear many Palestinians saying, we acknowledge, you know, the historic Jewish connection. We acknowledge your indigenous connection to that. You don't hear that anymore. But Khalidi could say that in 1899. And the other thing that Herzl says to Khalidi, which Jews don't say anymore, is, if Zionism bothers you, we'll go somewhere else. We don't say that anymore. You know, we're here to stay. And I think this letter is fascinating. And whenever I teach, you know, courses on Israeli, you know, Zionist Palestinian history, I often start or end with this letter, is because I think it frames so much of what we're talking about today over this, I guess, this contest over the Palestinians obviously being here for as a majority for far, far longer than the Jews have been here as a majority, and very much seeing Zionism as something that ruined their lives and that took their homeland away from them. And Zionists saying, well, you know, we only came here to do good. And the Palestinians obviously not experiencing that as good. And I think really any conversation between Israelis and Palestinians, even to this day, often starts from those two premises. And I think both of them need a lot of unpacking in order for us to be able to live together here in peace.
Oh, powerful, very, very powerful. I'm going to end just on one last question, because it's something that when I've been talking about the history and how we got here with people always say that, you know, the Palestinians have been offered peaceful resolution so many times and they've always said no. You know, they were offered a two-state solution in the Peel Commission, then by the United Nations in 1947. And then after that, there were other offer or peace talks like the Oslo Accords, and it was that with Yitzhak Rabin, I think. And, you know, every time they're offered a state of their own, they say no. So I just want to finish off this particular episode and for the history to kind of explain that, and if you can just talk me through that.
Yeah. So there have been many, many ideas of, I guess, partition, for lack of a better word, with various different maps of somehow creating, I guess, what today we call a two-state solution. And you're right, they go back all the way back to the Peel Commission and the Resolution 181 in 1947, and then Oslo and Camp David and Annapolis and Taba and, you know, all of those many other agreements, the roadmap, even the Trump peace plan in 2018. I think a lot of these so-called solutions, some of them are in Israel's favour, some of them are in the Palestinians' favour, but I don't think it's right just to blame one side or the other for these not happening. Like, for example, I'll give you one of the more recent ones, which was in Annapolis, where in 2007 Ehud Olmert was negotiating with Abu Mazen. And you can look at the maps of what they each offered each other. So, you know, Israel basically says to the Palestinians, you can have a Palestinian state on basically all of the West Bank except for about 5.5%. And the Palestinians then have a counter offer to Israel and says, we'll accept a Palestinian state, but we want only 1.5% of the land to be settlements. So there's an offer and there's a counter offer. Same thing in Camp David. Israel makes an offer over Jerusalem. Arafat makes a counter offer. And so there's always this, every negotiation has offers and counteroffers. And then both sides says, well, we made this offer. And then the other side says, well, we made this offer. And how could they not accept? This is so generous. So, you know, in the Palestinian narrative, you know, they say the fact that we agreed to Israel in the 1967 borders means that we've already compromised on 78% of historic Palestine. We're already saying 78% you can have. We don't want to compromise anymore on Gaza and the West Bank when we're already saying 78% of it is yours. On the Israeli narrative, where, you know, we see the whole thing as ours, we're saying, look, we're giving you so much of the West Bank and so much of Gaza and Jericho and, you know, the other places where there's been autonomy, that why should we give you any more? Why should we dismantle more settlements? Where dismantling those settlements could cause more rockets and attacks and those sorts of things. So I think that the story with peace offers is every peace offer has an offer and a counter offer. And again, I can go through all the maps if you want to, but it'll take a long time to do that. But I don't think it's fair to blame just one side or the other. But I do think that, you know, I remember reading a lot of books from negotiators who were in the room when these things happened. And one of the biggest reasons why these agreements never happened was trust. So Israelis always thought, you know what, on paper, maybe we can go with this, but I don't trust you to deliver. I don't trust you to keep your side of agreement, to stop terrorism, to arrest these people, to whatever. And the Palestinians looked at the Israeli side and said, oh, maybe we can live with like 90% of this, but I don't trust the Israelis to not, you know, the next day continue building settlements, continue arresting us, continue demolishing our houses. And I think that the problem why we don't have peace now is not because we haven't found the right solution, because there's solutions out there that I think a lot of people could live with. I think the issue is that we don't have trust, and you can't make peace with someone that you don't trust. And as long as there's no trust, and obviously what's happening now in this war that started on October 7th is diminishing trust, you know, more than, you know, almost anything else that's happened in our history. And I think it'll be very hard for us to trust each other for a very, very long time. But I think if you ever want to have peace, then you need to rebuild that trust. And that's also personally why I work in a peace building organization, because I believe that building trust is a very, very long process, and it takes years and years to build, and it's not an easy thing to do. And it's much, much harder. You know, you start a war in a minute. You know, wars are very quick to start, but peace takes generations to build. And I guess as an educator and a peace activist, my interest is in the long game. And, you know, when people say, oh, well, what about October 7th? And what about the Nakba? And what about, you know, all these horrible things that have happened? I'm like, you know, all of those things had things that happened before them. So we now exist because of education systems that we've had here, and because of incitement and demonization, where for years we've learned that the other side doesn't want peace, and the other side doesn't want to compromise, and the other side's a colonizer and a terrorist, and, you know, all those sorts of things. And, yeah, all those things happen. I'm not denying all those things happen, but if we ever want to live together, then, A, and it is really, really hard to say, but we need to forgive each other for a lot of the things we've done to each other. And B, we need to think of how do you create a future together where those terrible things we've done to each other don't happen anymore. And that is really the role of educators, to help people imagine those possibilities so that a better future is possible here.
You're ruining the last episode of this season, but I mean of this series. It's a little sneak peek for the future for the listeners. I just wanted to say that and I wonder, this is a question that I ask as well, and I wonder what you think about this. You know, people say and have said to me, if in 1948 the Palestinians had agreed to the two-state solution, then we would have been living peacefully side by side for so many years now. My question is, you know, if they had known what was going to come after 1948, if they had known that there was going to be the Nakba, that there would be, you know, occupation in Gaza for a while and a continuation of the occupation in the West Bank, maybe if they had known what their future was going to look like, they would have said yes in 1948. But at that time, they didn't have that foresight. You know, they didn't know that that was going to happen. And so, you know, it's very easy for us to say, oh, we would be, you know, they said no, and that's why we're not living peacefully right now. But back in that time, like, they were the majority. They were living there. Why should they have said yes to, you know, these Jews coming in and, you know, everything that we've just spoken about? So what, you know, is that a fair summary of why they would have said no, and it's not really very fair to say they shouldn't have said no?
Look, I think maybe in hindsight some Palestinians would look at what they were offered in 1947 for the size of an Arab state, which is much larger than any other subsequent peace offer, and say, yeah, that would have been great, and they'd happily take that today. But that didn't happen. And as I said, you know, I can't change the past. But I also think there's always a gap here between what we want and what's possible, or a dream and a reality, you know. And I think, you know, we call this podcast From the River to the Sea. There's always been a Palestinian dream here to be the sole independent sovereign here from the river to the sea. And there's also, you know, a Jewish dream to be the sole independent sovereign here from the river to the sea. And on both sides, there's a feeling that giving up an inch of that, saying to the other side, this doesn't belong to me, this belongs to you. You can put your flag here. You can put your synagogue there, your mosque there, your whatever there, is saying this doesn't belong to me anymore. And I think compromise, I'm you know, I'm a Western liberal kind of person, and I think compromise is a wonderful thing. And I know that for a lot of people here, compromise is seen as weakness and even betrayal in some cases. And and I think a lot of reasons why peace agreements didn't happen is because both Israeli and Palestinian societies, there's a very strong opposition to compromising on very fundamental things like Al-Aqsa, like the old city, like the Kotel, like the right of return, like our national flag, our anthem, our, you know, these fundamental symbols that peace might change, those symbols. People don't want to compromise on those things. And so, yes, if compromise had happened before, then, yeah, for sure we wouldn't be in the situation we are. But on the other hand, who knows, maybe those compromises could have happened and then other problems could have emerged as well. So, again, they're really impossible questions to ask. But I really feel that going forward we need to, and I know this is like an impossible thing and we'll talk about this in the last podcast a bit more, but, like, you know, this notion of compromise is not something you do when you lose. Compromise is something you do when you win. And if we can bring in that idea that my winning doesn't need to come at the expense of someone else's losing, and there are many solutions that do that, again, we'll talk about that in the last episode, then that could radically change our lives here. But for now, you know, we're stuck in a cycle of victimhood. And there's so much pain and so many bereaved mothers and fathers who are burying their children as we speak because of things that are just too horrifying to imagine. And I want that to stop. And I want there to be empathy here for people from all sides so that this place can be a home. And I think this place will never really be a home for Jews until it's a home for Palestinians, and it will never be a home for Palestinians until it's a home for Jews. And I think that's the future we need to strive for. I know I've just, like, talked a lot this podcast, Hannah, but I want to ask you how you feel now sort of hearing these arguments, you know, giving the Palestinian narrative, giving the Israeli narrative in a way that was maybe different from your Jewish education. What's going through your mind listening to all of these ideas?
So it's really interesting because as we were going through it, and I could even hear myself in asking these questions, like I think because I didn't learn all of this at school, and then I have had to go through this kind of like unlearning the fact that this was just one part of the narrative and not the whole thing, I feel like a lot of anger. Because I feel like I've been lied to. I feel like, I mean, I used the word brainwashed in one of my Instagram posts and people got really angry at that. But part of me does feel like I've been brainwashed. And so when I was asking these questions and we're talking about apartheid, we're talking about all these like really uncomfortable things about Israel, even though I feel this anger, like a part of me feels like, oh God, I'm being, you know, I'm being too critical here. like, I bet I should stop being so critical. Israel is a great pace. Like, I start to get defensive even within myself. Like, one part is criticizing, the other part is getting defensive of that criticism. And I think what you just said, though, is it's so perfect because it's like, it reminds me of privilege. I have this conversation a lot with privilege. Like, people who are privileged or people who have rights, if they think that another group of people then get those rights, then something will be taken away from them. But actually, we can all have rights. Just because another group has rights doesn't mean that it takes away from another group's, a person's rights. We can all have this privilege. And I think that's, you know, you kind of answered in that last monologue. You kind of like put together those two sides of me, like the criticism side and the side that then starts defending. It's like, hold on a second, like I can criticize and also feel proud of a place and feel a connection to this place because I clearly do. Like, even if I'm angry that I didn't get taught this and I feel like, you know, so appalled by things that I've learned about the apartheid and I hate it. I really, really hate it. But the reason why I hate it is because I care about this place so much. I want it to be better. I like, you know, because I'm proud of being Jewish, I want this state that is a Jewish state to be a good place. And I think, yeah, exactly what you said, like if we can make it better for Palestinians, then it will be better for Jews. And if we make it better for Jews, it will be good for Palestinians, just because making, you know, bringing someone else up doesn't mean that we're bringing someone else down, and one person's privilege doesn't have to come at the expense of someone else's.
No, I think that's...
Does that answer your question?
I think that's so true, and I think there's a lot of not only unlearning that you have to do to get to that point, but also a lot of relearning that you have to do to get to that point.
Exactly.
And it's something that, you know, I've been going through my whole life, and I feel like even though I teach courses on this, the more I learn about it, the less I understand, because every time that I learn, I find a new historical document and a new story, and then I experience things that are happening today. And a lot of times I change my beliefs as well. Like now, you know, I don't use the word apartheid to describe what's happening in Israel because I don't think it's a clear word that accurately captures what's going on here. I don't use the word colonialism either, even though I think there's aspects of both in Israel's treatment of the Palestinians. But I always think of how can I describe what we're doing here in a way that's maybe the most fairest way possible. And then more importantly, how can I act to educate people about it and then also to create a reality where that's not going to be our future here. And again, we'll have later podcast episodes that talk about those things. But I think it's a really important conversation to have, and I hope that the people listening to this, you know, are going through that process with us. And, you know, to all of our listeners, you know, we really care about you and love you, and we want to hear your questions as well, because you're on this journey with us. And that's how you learn and that's how you grow.
Mm. And I just want to add that it is really confusing. Like, it hurts. Growth actually physically hurts in your body. It definitely does in mine. Like, it's so scary to feel like you know something, and then that process of unlearning is so difficult, and it's very, very painful. And it's, you know, there's often a massive aversion to pain, and so we don't want to do it. We don't want to do the unlearning because it's just way too painful. But I feel like on the other side of it, there's actually, it's a really good thing. There's so much growth. I actually just love the feeling of growth. I've become accustomed to this feeling of unlearning and kind of enjoying it because it means that I'm, yeah, growing as a person and learning new things. And yeah, you can kind of look at it as a good pain. That's how I try and look at it. And this has definitely been a good pain, even though it doesn't, the good comes after. It doesn't feel good right now.
Yeah. And that's all. It's all part. It's like medicine always tastes shit, you know, but hopefully at the end it makes you feel better.
Exactly. Okay, well, yeah, thanks for coming on that little journey with us. It was long and big. I hope you made it to the end. Next time we are going to be talking about more going into this particular war Looking at Gaza, where Gaza kind of fits in. We didn't really talk this time about the disengagement in 2005. I want to talk about that, Itai, and ask you some questions about that. I want to talk to you about your experience on October 7. You were obviously in Israel at that time, and kind of move on from there and look at what's been happening, what's happened since October 7th. So, yeah, big podcast episode to come.
Sure, for sure.
The last thing is, as I said at the end of last episode, we do really want to hear from you. If you have questions for us, if you want to tell us some insights that you got from this, if you want to tell us anything at all, even if it's criticism, we're open to it. You can email us at fromtheyarra@gmail.com. And yeah, we'll hopefully get some, we'll have an episode of just questions. I don't know what we'll do yet, but we'll definitely find a way to answer them.
And we forgot one more thing. We have to say a big, big thank you to a
voice
that you can't hear on the podcast that is doing amazing work to bring this all to you in between our Zoom calls across the ocean and us trying to get our microphones to work with Audacity, and that is Ben. So a big toda rabba to Ben. We really appreciate all the sound engineering and all of your tech expertise that makes this all sound so beautiful.
Yeah, Ben, oh my God. I feel like we're gonna thank you each episode, so I'll let Itai thank you for this one, and then I'll get onto my mushiness to thank Ben on the next episode.
And we'll also put in the podcast description a few links to some books you can read and some other interesting podcasts that we hope that will help you along this journey.
Great. Thanks, Itai, and see you next time.
Thanks, Hannah. Be well.
Bye.